Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Slash Filmcast. I am David Chen and with me are
Devendra Hardawar
and Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show everyone. On this podcast today, we're going to do a weekly check-in, see how everyone's doing. We got a quick film news update before moving on to some what we've been watching. We have a new brief segment we're going to call Weekly Plugs, and then we're going to conclude with an in-depth review. This week we'll be talking about Relic, the new horror film that's available right now for rent on video on demand. You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. So a couple updates from last week. First of all, Jeff Cannata, you had a birthday, did you not?
I did. I did have a birthday on Saturday. I did.
Congrats.
August 1st.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Your first pandemic birthday.
Everybody remembers their first pandemic birthday.
What was it like, Jeff? What was it like having a birthday like during the pandemic?
Well, it was, I can imagine a lot of people listening have had birthdays during this 4 or 5 month period that we're all living through. So I don't think it's a unique situation, but it certainly is.
Maybe like 40 to 50% of people. Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. I don't think birthdays are evenly skewed throughout the year, but that's a statistics question.
I think that's how they are. I think that's how it works.
Do you really?
Also, I got my percentages wrong. But anyway, Jeff.
whatever the case, I had
whatever
one, and it was strange. Admittedly, that you can't really do anything. I mean, I'm at an age where you don't really do much on your birthday anyway. But it was nice. It was nice. My wife's parents offered to take my children for the night, both of them. So we actually had an evening without any children at all, and we were able to go to get takeout at a place that we really, really like that we never get a chance to go to because it's really far. You know, we do these check-ins and, we do these check-ins and you say, Jeff, how's Los Angeles? And yeah. I speak as a representative of Los Angeles. But the truth is, I don't really live in Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles County, but I live in the San Fernando Valley. I live north of what everyone would consider to be the main part of Los Angeles, north of Hollywood, north of downtown Los Angeles. So I live on the outskirts. Los Angeles is a big sprawling metropolis that is hard to pin down as any. There's not one place right. that is Los Angeles.
Are you like Brad Pitt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Jeff?
Yes, I'm even farther actually than Brad Pitt. I'm in Woodland Hills, so I'm a ways away. But I still feel like I'm in Los Angeles, especially when there's no pandemic time. I'm constantly in Hollywood. I'm constantly driving all around. I go to downtown. You're constantly in LA. You're just constantly, you know, I was working places. I'm going all the time. But since this has started, the last several months, I've been in Woodland Hills. You know, I've been in my house. I've been in a 2 mile radius of my house. You know, I would go on runs. I would go on bike rides with my kid. I would make short jaunts to the nearest Ralph's grocery store and Trader Joe's, but that was the extent of it. And I didn't even realize how disconnected I was from LA, really, LA. Then on my birthday, when we finally, because the kids were gone and my wife and I were like, let's go to our favorite ramen place. In fact, I was inspired by Tanpopo ever since watching that movie for review on the show, I've been craving really good ramen. And sadly, in Woodland Hills, I have not found decent ramen anywhere near here. But there is a place on Melrose that I really love in LA that is my favorite ramen that I've ever had. And so we don't really get there very often, especially with kids now. So it was an opportunity to go get takeout ramen from there. There's a really amazing cake place there. We also got slices of this incredible cake that was nearby there. Anyway, so it was an occasion to drive down to Melrose, which was, you know, ground zero for a lot of the protesting and rioting that happened a while back. And I just haven't been there in many, many months. And I gotta say, guys, it was surreal.
Oh, yeah.
Surreal.
I can imagine.
Driving, first of all, no traffic. We got there in like 10 minutes. It was insane. It was insane to drive down La Brea and Hollywood Boulevard and Melrose Avenue without traffic, like just breezing your way through those places. Unbelievable. I'd never, ever in my life have I experienced that. And that was strange. And the number of businesses that are boarded up or for lease, places that are for lease, that are just, it's like a ghost town down there. It is creepy, and you really do feel like, oh, this is that thing in the movies when there's an apocalypse and you drive through the, you know, this is Will Smith playing golf on the battleship with his dog walking down Main Street in the middle of the day.
Let me tell you, Jeff, like a week before I left New York, I had to take the subway in to go to my office, and terrifying. It is a terrifying experience to go through a city that is full of life that is instead like completely vacant of people and all boarded up. And it was so, so weird. I have to ask you though, Jeff, what did you do with the ramen? Did you bring it home? Or did you guys like eat it right there?
Did you eat it
because
in the car?
Takeout ramen
no.
is rough.
Yeah, takeout ramen is rough. I tell you, it was still glorious. But we took it home. We drove all the way back home. But again, got home very fast.
Okay.
But we took it home and put it in our own bowls and then ate outside in the backyard in the nice weather.
Nice touch to put it in the own bowls. Because they give it to you in the plastic bowls usually.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It doesn't feel right. To eat
that,
it in the plastic.
That old dude at the beginning of Tampopo would have smacked me in the back of the head if I had done
Correct.
That.
Correct. I'm so glad you internalized this, Jeffrey. That's very heartwarming.
Entire point of Tampopo, yes.
I tapped the meat and I communed with it. You know, you always want to tap your meat before you do anything. That's what I found.
Yep. That's a good lesson for life. Tap that meat. Anyway, Jeff, I'm so glad to hear that you were able to find some joy in the current situation. So hope you had a happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for sharing that with us. But glad you're doing okay.
Yeah, hanging in there.
So on last week's episode of the Slash Filmcast, which, by the way, I think is rapidly becoming just Jeff's descent into madness, and to a lesser extent our own.
You ask, so I share.
Do you hear me blaming you, Jeff? I'm just explaining what's happening. So last week's episode of the podcast, Jeff, you described a issue that you were having in which mice or a rat was in your house. I mean, first of all,
I think it was mice. Yeah.
Any update on the mice situation?
Yes, a wonderful development. I believe we have. It's been several nights now with no mice droppings, no mice damage. I think we have successfully figured out how they were entering the house and have successfully blocked that entrance.
Nice.
And we had dudes out to the house with that foam stuff that I'm sure you guys have seen, that like crazy foam stuff they spray into holes and it hardens. Ugly as hell. Super ugly. But now it's all around the sides of my house and like behind the dishwasher and underneath the stove. And so I think we boarded up, we blocked things for a while and the mice weren't coming. And we figured like, well, that's a good sign. And then so we, you know, have foamed all those orifices. after you tap your meat, you want to foam your orifices. That's the takeaway this week, I think.
And then you want to pass the yolk from mouth to mouth. Basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, we're not going to talk about that part of the night.
The three lessons of the Slash Film Cast.
Yeah, so it's in our show notes every week. It's good news. It's good news. I can't say that the problem has been eliminated, but certainly the symptoms of the problem that were most traumatic and disruptive to our lives have been curtailed. So that is already a win, you know?
Great.
I'm so glad to hear that. You know, I have a little bit of an update this week, which is that I am forming a COVID bubble with someone, and more details about this will be released in the future.
you guys will formally announce.
There will be a nightly podcast.
We'll formally announce our bubble later, yeah. But yeah, I'm
Your
forming a COVID bubble.
Your publicist will be revealing pictures of the bubble.
Yep. We are going to kind of be very specific about which outlet we're going to choose to unveil the bubble.
Of course. Why wouldn't you? Yeah. You know, people and us have both been asking, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's going to be in the New York Times bubble section. It's really high profile. Yeah. Really high
New
profile.
New York Times should have a bubble section these days.
So essentially what happened is the space across the alley from our house. Devinder, you've been to my house before, think, right? Yeah. So you know, basically we're surrounded on either side by a bunch of townhouses, mm-hmm. right? And it's literally like 10 feet away is like how far away, like door to door, 10 feet. And one of those townhouses became available for rent. And I there's a couple people I knew who were potentially looking for a place to live. And so I pitched it to a couple people as like, hey, here's an idea. Like maybe we could bubble up. And lo and behold, one of my friends accepted that offer. So we're going to be...
This is madness, by the way. But go on. Go on, Dave.
But
you put an ad out for Bubble Friends?
I didn't
put an ad. But also, you have to live right next door to me. So this all better go well.
Yep. No, for sure. It's definitely a risk. But yeah, this is a friend who per our conversation about bubbles, you know, that are very... enlightening conversation in which I compared it to being a YouTube collaboration. This friend,
I love the idea of your ad. Me, a very germ conscious film lover.
Wait, when you
looking
say my
for
ad.
Conversation, you willing to share your bubble with me and only me. Interested? Call immediately.
Dave, you're recreating the influencer house thing that is happening in LA. So congrats.
You really are doing
the YouTube thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're not going to make a YouTube channel, but yes. So one of my friends, and it wasn't like I wrote an ad, Jeff. Okay. Stop being such a silly goose, Jeff. So we're going to bubble up and it's going to be cool because we're good friends and it's just going to be like, here's what I think. You know, David Brooks wrote this article not too long ago in The Atlantic about the nuclear family. And the article is basically about how the nuclear family is a historical accident. Basically, like there's a 50-year time period in human history when the nuclear family was a big deal. And for hundreds and thousands of years before that, it wasn't a big deal. Like it was, you'd live with extended family or you'd live with like a commune of people, basically. You'd be in a hunter-gatherer society, you know, like whatever. And then for about like 50 years, the nuclear family was a big deal.
Right.
Anyway, I think that in his article is basically like, this is pre-COVID. He was like, we should reconceptualize what we think of as the family because like our current society is not built.
Or you mean actually go back to the way things used to be before everybody cloistered off into the suburbs, basically, in their own single family homes. Like it's pretty much that. Yeah.
I think it's more just like be willing to open your mind to like what the possibility of a family can be.
Sure.
You know?
You're saying family that isn't defined by blood.
Yes. Absolutely correct.
You know, because family used to mean multiple generations in the same home.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
And yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, I think that like with the new COVID thing, you know, I don't want to get too philosophical about it, but even though that's exactly what I'm doing,
but you literally have decided these people are your family.
Just pop in now. Like there's a pop-in rule. It's great.
Dave is the single white female antagonist. He doesn't even know it. The other people are like, yeah, we decided we would hang out with these folks that live nearby us once, and now they're calling us their family, and they're expecting us to be over every night. It's very disconcerting.
Well, you know, Jeff, I'm fine with you making fun of me because we've been friends for a long time, and also... It was your birthday recently, but I happen to think that, you know, I'm pretty serious about this. I mean, I think that, like, you were talking about, like,
this starts as let's all hang out and be in a germ bubble, and it ends up with Dave's wearing your face as a mask.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for those positive thoughts on what's happening over in Seattle for me.
Sorry. No, go ahead. No.
It's okay. It's okay. We can move on.
I genuinely want to hear this. I want to hear this. You have you had the first time where you guys have come over and swapped germs yet?
No.
Invite them in. Would you like to breathe my recycled air? Welcome.
All right, guys, we're going to move on. Jake W. writes in slashcast@gmail.com. Weird that this is the first thing that gets me to write into the show, but Jeff does not need to own a cat. He can borrow one, maybe from a friend or my local pet shelter.
True.
My local pet shelter lets you foster a cat for a while. Hope your mouse problem goes away soon. Now, Jeff, we forwarded you this email about the idea of borrowing a cat, which seemed to me pretty logical. Like, it doesn't seem like a completely wild idea.
It's a win-win.
But you didn't seem super receptive to it.
I got this from a number of people that made this suggestion, which, forgive me, I think it is a well-intentioned and good-hearted suggestion made in good faith from a lot of people, much like Dave's last conversation. and yet, I had a similar response in that I find it to be insane. It's an insane idea to me that I would somehow borrow a cat for a while. Like, I'm going to bring a cat into a home with a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I'm expecting to have that be a temporary thing and not
out? That is certainly dangerous. I wonder though, Jeff, do you know how big cats are? Like, I wonder if you've seen a cat before, because you're definitely you're bringing a 50-pound dog into this house. Yeah.
Jeff's conception of cats come from the Beethoven movies, basically.
My conception of everything comes from the Beethoven movies. It's the biggest
the Beethoven movies are canonical in Jeff.
Canonical, yeah. No, I'm not worried about them injuring my kids. I'm worried about my kids falling in love with them.
Oh, yeah.
And then me saying, no, they only here for a short time. Sorry. And then my kids being, you know,
they have to learn loss sometime, Jeff. Okay.
Yeah, I guess.
Take away
the cat. Couldn't you then get them a cat though if they really enjoyed it?
I don't want to have the whole point of this story is that there's animals in my house that I don't want.
Let me tell you, Jeff, the nice thing about having cats though and kids is that the kids will just play with the cats. Like it is like free distraction time for them to just like hang out and play together. So that is, that's offloading parent time. That means you can check Twitter.
Some sort of cat babysitter is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, completely.
Well, that is tempting, I have to admit. But I'm reminded of a story I told my children a number of times. Maybe you guys have heard of it. Was it the how does it go? I got a fly. To catch the fly, I got a frog. Right, to catch the frog, I got a like that.
It doesn't work because it's just a cat.
It's madness. It's the whole point is that I don't want animals in my house. And people are like, you know what the solution to having animals in your house are? Get other animals in your house. And like, I don't want that. I don't want animals in my house. Jeff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we tried. We tried. But I'm glad that your rodent problem has since resolved itself.
Well, before, I don't know that for sure, but it's an uptick in sanity, that's for sure.
Before we get to what we've been watching, one other thing I wanted to mention, we've discussed this issue before on the Slash Filmcast before, but we learned this week that Netflix is now letting people watch things faster or slower with new playback speed controls. You can stream up to 0.5 times slower or 1.5 times faster. Now,
only on Android right now.
Only on Android, right. So I couldn't do it on like my Apple TV or anything like that.
Nope. And they said they are working on testing iOS and web, but still no like TV interface.
Now, I was originally very resistant to this. We've obviously had like many chats about the morality, the ethic, whatever you want to call it, of speeding up, slowing down podcasts. I mean,
I would like to point out, I don't think we've ever come out against slowing down. right?
Oh, okay. Well,
you know, slowing down is a different issue, right? Slowing down is a different issue, in my opinion.
Because it's like an accessibility thing, in your opinion?
Yeah. I don't think anybody's slowing down a podcast for any other reason than they have a need to slow it down. I think.
I mean, you're a sound drunk.
I have a terrible confession to make, guys. Okay.
Here we go.
Which is not that I don't listen to podcasts sped up, but I have started using the remove silence feature on my podcast player.
But that feels different, I guess. That could remove, like, you know, useful pauses, but I do that as well because it compresses things, but you still get, you know, everybody's tone. Everything still sounds the same, basically.
I just want to I want to describe my emotional reaction to this news about the Netflix thing. Is I started being like, well, really sad, you know, disposable entertainment culture we live in. People can just speed it up and charge through it no matter what. Jeff, we just had that whole talk a couple weeks ago on the podcast about how, you know, people spend years working on these movies and TV shows, and we just cram it all down like we're speed eating something.
Yes. You know?
And this is yet another sign of how entertainment is becoming more and more disposable. But then I read this article at TheVerge.com, which describes the news, and I think this is very much worth keeping in mind here. The article notes, quote, both the National Association of the Deaf and the National Federation of the Blind commended Netflix on adding the playback features. Since captions are slowed down and also sped up to keep in time with the images on screen, it can help deaf people who might prefer the captions at a slightly slower speed, according to Howard A. Rosenblum, CEO of the National Association of the Deaf. On the other side, many people in the blind community can understand and appreciate audio played at a much faster pace than what might be comfortable for most sighted people, said Everett Bacon, a board member on the National Federation of the Blind, end quote. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. It's like, hey, this is, you can think of it primarily as an accessibility feature, I think. And accessibility features can often have benefits for able-bodied people. You know, like, I think closed captioning is a great example of an accessibility feature that, like, I use all the time, so I don't need to crank up my volume. So while I'm not saying that the Netflix thing is not a sign of the, you know, culture's inexorable slide towards thinking of entertainment
why Netflix did it. That's true. They were like, let's think about the blind community that can hear things better and faster. I don't think that's what happened. But
I'm sure that was part of it. But yeah, I think you're right that, like, maybe it allows, there's people who want to burn through this stuff faster and they want to help facilitate it. But
we've talked about this before, by the way. Like, these buttons, have you forgotten what was on your VHS player and what was on your DVD player? They had slowdown options. They had speed up options. Like, there were similar things.
Yeah, but I don't recall it replicating the sound or, like, keeping the sound at the same pitch, for instance, which is something that this does. So I'm saying I went from this being a very sad thing about our culture to actually maybe it's kind of a happy thing for our culture. So good on Netflix for adding that feature. And I think people of a wide variety of abilities will benefit from it.
Right. So. Like, my feelings on these things really comes down to, is it affecting me? Is it, you know, this new feature, is it going to make my life actually worse? No, it's not. It's just people who prefer to do these things. I wouldn't do this to a movie, probably. But, you know, some people may. I think the funny thing is, it is probably the perfect way to watch a Netflix TV show. Think about it. Like half of those shows are just treading water and wasting time. So what better way to binge on the next season of Umbrella Academy is to just burn through the slow parts, right?
I do think there is an implication. You know, people, filmmakers have expressed concern about this feature. Filmmakers make things to be watched and listened to in a specific way with a specific pacing, and
there's
this will disrupt
editor
that.
Who is agonizing over every frame to find out what the perfect pause is before you hear the next line to make it land in a specific way. And all due respect to this organization for the blind, I have no problem with people that need something slowed down or that need the captions to go slower or whatever. Any of that, obviously, I think we should do as much accessibility stuff as possible. I have a hard time believing that simply because you're blind and you're capable of listening to it faster. It somehow is an accessibility issue to let you just consume it faster. Like I would think if I was blind, if and God knows I'm getting there closer every day, the idea of not listening to it at the pace that the filmmaker wanted to, I don't think that that would be something that I would want. I don't know. It just feels like the speeding up is the issue for me. And I understand and I respect the accessibility side of it. And I think it's wonderful that you can slow things down. You can make things clearer for people that may have a harder time reading captions fast or whatever the case. Slowing down is not my issue. It's the get it in faster, go faster, faster, speed up, you know, break the rhythm that was established by the creator. I don't think there's any real reason that that's better.
Well, let us know what you out there think, listeners. /filmcast@gmail.com, where you can write in. Will you be using this feature? If so, why? We'd be interested in hearing from you. But it is a feature that's going to be out there, and it will probably be rolling out wider in the days to come.
Hey, everyone. I just wanted to talk about how I've been dealing with my own stress and anxiety, something we're all dealing with these days. And that's with Feels, which is premium CBD that's delivered right to your doorstep. It naturally helps you reduce stress, anxiety, pain, sleeplessness, any of those things. I use Feels in situations where I know I may need a little help relaxing. So that's maybe before a big interview, when we used to travel. It was really helpful for that, and I definitely will be taking it on future trips. Unlike the stuff you find at a lot of bodegas and drugstores, it's really high-quality CBD, and it's really easy to take, too. You just have to place a few drops under your tongue, and you'll feel something pretty quickly. Finding your right dose is definitely a thing you'll have to learn over time, but Feels also offers real human support to help you figure out which dosage you may actually want. And best of all, it works naturally, so you don't have a high or hangover or addiction to worry about. So I'd recommend joining the Feels community to get Feels delivered right to your door every month. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. And I'm just going to read a disclaimer here, which I think everybody should know. Representations regarding the efficacy and safety of Feels have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA only evaluates food and drugs, not supplements like this product. This product is not intended to diagnose, prevent, treat, or cure any disease. Feels has really helped me deal with anxiety in many ways, and I hope it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/filmcast, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/filmcast to become a member and get 50% off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/filmcast.
Let's move on to what we've been watching this week. This week, I had a chance to watch a movie called Speed Cubers. Jeff Cannata, it sounds like you watched this movie as well.
I did. I bawled my way through it. I was like ugly crying through Speed Cubers.
Why? So how did you, because I tweeted and I made a video about it, but how did you hear about it? Did you see it on Netflix pop up on your home screen? Or
I did. What? I think I got a tweet from someone else saying, you got to watch this. Yeah. Actually, when I used a lot of recommendations this week from people I didn't even know to determine what I watched this week, and I, you know, this is the kind of thing that I'm already fascinated by. We've talked many times on the show about, you know, like subgroups of subgroups, like niches of a niche, a real very specific category of community that's super passionate about a very obscure thing. I love that. I love looking at these communities of people who like dedicate their lives to some skill that is such a tiny margin of humans even pay attention to it, but they are obsessed. And I love that. You know, this is of course about people that solve Rubik's Cube puzzles as fast as possible, mostly young people, and the competition that arises out of it. And I love the fact that even when we get to the biggest competition, the world championships, there's like 30 people in the audience. You know, this is a niche, right? And I love that. I love anything that takes a look at those subgroups and those cultures that are built up around the tiniest little focus of a hobby. But really what this documentary is, which is, by the way, very short. I think it's less than 50 minutes. it's a story about these two boys, these friends that are, it's an extraordinary, heartwarming, life-affirming tale about just being a good person, being a really good person. And I was ugly crying through it, like throughout, just bawling my head off. And I really recommend it to anybody because it will make you want to be a better person. It's just about parents who have to deal with a child with autism and coming to that child rather than asking that child to come to them, you know, metaphorically speaking, finding a way into that child's inner life and connecting with that child in a way they didn't think was possible. My daughter has brain damage, and you know, it really affected me. This beautiful tale of these parents finding a way in, and then this boy, this champion speed cuber, who has all the records, and then along comes this other kid who breaks all his records, and they yet, despite that, can be friends. You can treat him with respect and dignity and love, and I just found it to be an extraordinary tale that made me want to be a better person. So I highly recommend Speed Cubers.
It's great. It's like a 40-minute long documentary. It lands what it's trying to land. It gets out. If anything, this is one of those movies I thought it was a little too short. I'm like, I want to know more about this world of speed cubing, you know? And there's people who solve Rubik's Cubes with their feet, you know, yeah. And they
we don't even see them in the documentary.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, I'm like, dude, I want to see more of the feet people. there's like 4x4, 5x5 cubes that are, you know, much more difficult than the 3x3s. And I'm like, I want to learn more about that, you know. So it really introduced me to this world in a way that made me want to learn more, which I think is the mark of a great documentary.
But it's kind of like almost only tangentially about speed cubing, you know, right? Speed cubing is the excuse to talk about these two people, really, you know.
I think that's right. A great analogy someone on Letterboxd said, I'm sorry, I don't know exactly who, but I think someone on Letterboxd said, this is like watching King of Kong, but everyone in the movie's nice.
Yeah.
It's like kind of a sports rivalry, but imagine if the two people who are rivals loved each other, you know.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, that's so heartwarming. And yeah, it made me cry. It's really great. I would really recommend you check it out. Even if you're not into speed cubing, which the vast majority of people I know aren't, you should still watch this movie. It's actually called The Speed Cubers, I believe. So
they
speed
stole
cubers.
The from Flora's Lava and used it here, which is really nice of them to do. Especially in this era we're living in, this sort of the Trump doctrine that says, you know, you either win and insult everyone else along the way, or you're nothing, right? Winning is everything. Where I was raised, and I'm trying to raise my kids with that old adage that says it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game, right? We've completely abandoned that as a American culture. This whole like how you play the game is important, because people are just like, no, cheat, screw your buddy, do whatever you need to do as long as you win. It's become that, you know, just win baby mentality in this country. And here is this view of a very small insular community where the top two people in the world at it go, no, we want to win. We're trying to win, but it's also how we do it. It's also being decent, being good to each other, and coming at it with love and gratitude. It's a lesson out of this highly unlikely little universe. It's a lesson that can be applied, I think, to everything we do.
The movie is The Speed Cubers. Check it out on Netflix. I had a chance to watch a movie on Netflix called Tread. It's Friday night. Open up Netflix, and this movie gets served to me. There's a description. It's called, this documentary reconstructs the pivotal moments that drove a man on a rampage to destroy a small town with a bulldozer he fortified in secret.
Oh, this is the bulldozer guy movie.
Yeah. And I'm like, yes! Man, this movie.
I have been meaning to see this.
I'm like, man, Netflix really gets me that it served this one straight up to me.
Would it be great if like there was just like a visual representation of the algorithm and just like winked at you? And yeah, he's like, thanks, buddy. You got it. You got it, Netflix.
This movie is directed by a man named Paul Sollett, who I interviewed on the Slash Filmcast like many, many years ago, I want to say. This was like, I interviewed this guy 11 years ago. He had made a movie called Grace, which had premiered at Sundance, and it was very good. It was a really great low-budget horror film. And he made this documentary in like 2019. It's called Tread. And this documentary is awesome. I just need to say it's very, very good. I had never heard of this story. Did you guys hear about this story? Like,
yes,
did you
I remember
hear about this
when
like, it happened.
This was,
I remember
this,
that, yeah.
This was being thrown all around social media. Like, it was a crazy, crazy story. Yeah.
So, this was in 2004, a professional welder in Granby, Colorado drove a fortified bulldozer through town. And it was an international news story for a day. And then I think Ronald Reagan died the day afterwards.
I remember that it was like everybody was like, "It's falling down. It's falling down in real life. It's falling down. It's the because falling down had come out before that, right? Yeah. I remember that."
And the movie is really compelling, and I think it's also like a pretty great allegory for the Trump era. I mean, I'm not going to go into detail, but suffice to say, this guy felt very, very aggrieved, and he was very disturbed. And he recorded all these tapes explaining why he was about to do what he did. And the movie uses those tapes to kind of reconstruct the events leading up to this fateful day. I mean, what he did is I want to say it's incredible, but that like it sounds like I'm praising him in some way. Yeah. You know what I mean? But it is
a Breaking Bad level scenario, right?
Yeah.
God he went there instead of AR-15. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, there was you got to watch this movie, Jeff, because it's not quite that simple, right? Like,
yeah.
There was I will say that it was a monumental task of engineering what he was able to accomplish, because he essentially designed a machine that no one could stop. And people tried like shooting at it and throwing grenades at it. You know, like they did everything they could to stop this thing. And anyway, it is a fascinating documentary that kind of shows you how this guy got into, I would say, a vicious circle, kind of like a toxic cycle with the people around him. You guys know, and I think we've all been in this situation. Maybe we are in this situation. with each other on the podcast right now.
Yeah.
But you know how some people, like, sometimes they get in a relationship with someone where it becomes toxic and like nothing can redeem it. Like
I said I was sorry. I didn't let you talk about your germ circle. I'm sorry.
Things that are meant to be kind gestures basically are interpreted in the worst possible way in bad faith, right?
Oh, like, that's called marriage.
there's a situation where, like, no matter what the other person does, it's the relationship is irredeemable. The relationship is irredeemable. This guy basically had that kind of relationship with an entire town. And wow. The movie examines, you know, the upsetting consequence of that. So,
oh boy.
It's fascinating, and people already know what happened, so I'm not going to give away anything. Like, I've already held back many of the details from the movie, and I will continue to hold them back, so I'm not going to say. But I'll just say that the way in which they were able to convey what occurred, right? I'm not going to reveal how they convey what occurred, but like obviously at some point, they need to either reconstruct it themselves, or they need to use archival footage.
They built a giant. They rebuilt the machine, didn't they?
I'm not going to say what happens. I'm not going to say what happens. You just have to watch the movie yourself. But I'll say the way in which they reconstructed the terrifying events were really, really effective. Really, really well done.
I'm hyped for this
movie. Stop motion claymation animation. That's my guess. This does not sound like the feel good. hit that the Speed Cubers was to me.
No, I actually watched these movies back to back too.
Those two movies really, I think, encapsulates the emotions we're all feeling right now. We want the Speed Cubers, but we feel Tread.
Yes. No,
that's so true.
That's so true, Devendra. That's so true. Okay. Finally, I just want to give a quick shout out to this. So I have been hosting with relative frequency these watch parties online. And both Amazon and Netflix in the United States have features now where you can watch a movie or TV show along with other people and chat together about it in a chat room. And so oftentimes on my Twitter account, at Dave Chensky, that's Dave Chen SKY, I'll say, hey, I'm hosting an Amazon watch party. And I'll drop a link to the watch party and a bunch of people will join and we'll chat and have a good time. And that's happened a bunch of times. And I also actually created a site, a free website at jointhewatchparty.com. It's where I drop links whenever this happens. But I recently did one of these for, it was late at night and I think I was editing a podcast or something. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to throw something on in the background and I'm gonna put something on that even if I need to stop watching it halfway through, it's not going to be a problem. And so I chose Samsara, which is a movie by Ron Frick. And I don't know if you guys know Samsara, but it's basically the entire movie is just no dialogue. It's just a bunch of high-res shots.
You put on a beautiful screensaver while you worked.
It's from high-res shots from things around the world, basically. And I couldn't stop watching. I watched it all the way to the end. Because it is so incredibly well done. Ron Frick, it basically has like extremely high-res cameras shooting scenes that like feel like they open up your conception of what planet Earth can be, or what planet Earth is, I should say. So Samsara is great. It's on Prime Video. Check it out. But I also got so into this. I was like, oh my gosh, that was such a compelling watching experience. I got the Blu-ray for Baraka, which is the predecessor movie for that, which is also really impressive. And I just wanted to talk about it briefly because, Devendra, I thought you'd appreciate this. Basically, Baraka was released on Blu-ray. On the Blu-ray cover, it's like 8K remaster, right? And it's not an 8K Blu-ray or anything, but it's the 8K remaster. And I read the Wikipedia description of how they were able to generate this 8K thing. And this is really fascinating. It says, following DVD releases, in 2007, the original 65mm negative of Baraka was rescanned at 8K resolution with equipment designed specifically for Baraka at Photochem Laboratories. The automated 8K film scanner, operating continuously, took more than 3 weeks to finish scanning more than 150,000 frames, taking approximately 12 to 13 seconds to scan each frame, producing over 30 terabytes of image data in total. After a 16-month-long digital intermedia process, including a 96 kilohertz 24-bit audio remaster by Stearns for the DTS HD audio soundtrack of the film.
I like all these acronyms and numbers. It's great.
The result was re-released on DVD and Blu-ray disc in October of 2008. At the time, project supervisor Andrew Oron described the reissue of Baraka as arguably the highest quality DVD that has ever been made.
Yeah. You know, all that work, they're good for like decades of film formats. Like they could just like, oh, 8K is here. Like we have, let's just drop Baraka. We got it.
Into the 8K. Yeah, and the Blu-ray does, in fact, look incredible. I do think that the movies are very similar. There are scenes that are even like in the same places in both movies. Baraka is definitely a more optimistic movie, though. Samsara is kind of much more dark in its depiction of humanity, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think they're both great, and if you're looking for something interesting to watch that it doesn't have any plot, it's just a bunch of beautiful things to look at, things that are going to make you think, things that are going to make you appreciate your place in the world.
Yeah.
I would check out both of these movies.
You know, now is probably a great time to rewatch these movies or watch them for the first time too, because we're trapped. We cannot reach out and travel and touch these things. Like this is why I love travel shows, and I'm doing a big travel show binge again because I'm stuck at home like everybody else. So good call, Dave. I want to check these out again.
The movies are Samsara and Baraka. Check them out. Samsara is on Prime Video.
It's time for me to jump in here and tell you about our sponsor, Lightstream. If you're carrying any credit card debt right now, you got to get out from under it. You got to get out from under it. I try to pay off my credit cards every single month. But if you have credit card debt, a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream can help you mark them paid in full. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that is exactly what they deliver. You can roll balances from multiple credit cards into one single monthly loan payment and get a low fixed interest rate, free up more of your money in your monthly budget. Say goodbye to your credit card bills and take even more control of your money with Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans. They have rates from just 5.95% APR with auto pay, and there are absolutely no fees, which is huge, 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 huge. Just for listeners to the Slash Filmcast, apply now and get an additional rate discount to save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/filmcast. That's lightstream.com/filmcast for an additional discount. lightstream.com/filmcast. Subject to credit approval, rate includes a 0.50 auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/filmcast for more information.
Devinder Hardwar, what have you been watching this week?
Oh, I checked out Black is King, which is Beyonce's visual album, I guess. This thing is so weird and so beautiful. So, yeah, she is credited as directing this thing, along with some other visual artists. This is basically a short film based on The Gift, which was the sort of like the album she released that was related to The Lion King. So sort of like, you know, the other album that came out alongside the Black Panther soundtrack. I think that was just the Black Panther soundtrack. But it's this weird thing of her. It's a live action reinterpretation of the Lion King story, and using like little bits of dialogue here. Like there's some James Earl Jones stuff, there's like some iconic lines, but it's also going back and back into like religious iconography and things that are centered around Africa and African cultures and, you know, ancient African religions. It is a very wild thing, but I think this is probably the most you know, The Lion King, probably not the most like culturally respectable thing out there when it comes to Africa and so many things, and ripping off an idea from, you know, Japanese cartoon as well. I think this is probably one of the most like culturally interesting things to happen from The Lion King. And I think this also kind of describes like why the hell Beyonce was in the Lion King live action remake to begin with, right? Like she didn't need that. She was barely in the movie. But I wonder if like part of it was just her negotiating like, okay, Disney, give, like, I'm going to tell my Lion King. And that's basically what this is. So this is a beautiful series of videos and kind of like a broad sketch of a Lion King like story. But it's amazing. I don't know if you guys have heard The Gift. That was a really interesting album. Like, it wasn't like a typical Beyonce thing, because she brought in a whole bunch of other folks to make music that was sort of inspired by The Lion King. So I found that to be fascinating. This movie is just beautiful. Like, this is Lemonade level quality going on here of her making a grand statement about African culture and its place in the world and the beauty of it. So I'd highly recommend everybody go check this out right now. It would actually, I think, fit alongside the whole Samsara and Baraka thing, because it is a beautiful thing. Like, it's a construction of beautiful images and things we've kind of never really seen before. So I would highly recommend this. And to me, it's incredible that Beyonce's out there doing this.
How do you consume Black is King? Like, how do you actually view
it? It's on Disney Plus. It's right there at the top of the page.
That's right, Disney Plus. Yeah.
You launch, and there's a huge banner at the top of the page. You just click that, you see the movie. It's great. This thing is astounding. It looks amazing, too. Like, I think on any modern TV, this is going to be, like, to me, this feels almost like a spiritual successor to the whole idea of Samsara and Baraka, except it's trying to tell, you know, actual story in a very, like, roundabout way, I guess. It's amazing. Go check it out. It's a beautiful thing. I'm so glad she had the power to just make this thing. Like, this is myth-making by Beyoncé, right? This is her thinking of African stories and its place in the world, but also this is just her. Like, this is Beyoncé saying, hey, who else can do this right now? I'm the queen, you know, bow before me. So go watch Black is King.
Black is King is on Disney Plus. Jeff Cannata, other than Speed Cubers, what else have you been watching this week?
It's the Speed Cubers to you, Dave.
Good call.
Which, again, everyone should watch, and yep, it will make you a better person. I got a tweet this week. Actually, all three of us did. From Peter Miller. I don't know Peter, but Peter tweeted at us saying, if you're looking for a really good sit, just 56 minutes, I recommend I, Pastafari, a great documentary. I took Peter up on that. One of the things that I find so frustrating about Twitter is that I will, from time to time, get recommendations from listeners and want to find myself wanting to watch something. And I will go, oh, yeah, I saw that in my Twitter feed. Somebody sent me a recommendation. And I'll never be able to find it. I just can't find it. It's just a terrible, terrible way to give me recommendations because the time I want to know about it, it's hard to find in my feed. I can't remember.
Have you considered using the bookmark or heart feature on Twitter?
I guess I should do that. There were times when I would like cut and paste or take screenshots or something. And then, you know, that's even in the heat of the moment, you're like, ooh, that sounds interesting. But you're doing the rest of your Twitter feed, and I don't know. I'm bad at that.
Heart or bookmark them. It's built into the thing.
But then I've hearted and bookmarked, and I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'll try that. Anyway, the reason I'm saying this is there was this perfect storm of events that led the moment that I needed to watch something with that tweet coming in. So it was one of those things where I was like, okay, I'll watch this. I actually had to pony up money. I had to rent it. But I did. And thank you, Peter, because I, Pastafari is a documentary I enjoyed. I don't think it's the Speed Cubers level, but it is. It was entertaining. The idea is there is a religion called Pastafari that clearly started as a parody.
Oh, yeah.
But many people have heard of this. This is the flying spaghetti thing. Monster. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Early 2000s. Everybody heard about it. If you were on, you know, AOL Instant Messenger, you heard about the flying pasta monster. Basically, the idea that this is spaghetti monster. It's like, you know, if you tell me there's an invisible man in the sky controlling all events, I tell you there's an invincible flying pasta monster in the sky controlling events. What's the difference? Well, this documentary examines people that have taken this to its logical conclusion, actually going to court to attempt to be recognized as an actual religion, wearing colanders on their heads as religious headgear, asking for their passport photos and driver's licenses to be taken with their religious headgear on, because there are exemptions for religious headgear for people who have that as part of their belief system. Because, you know, you're not able to wear headgear or a hat of any kind when you get those photos taken to have it be used on an official government document. And to be fair, most of this movie takes place and examines stuff that is not in the United States. There is some United States stuff in this documentary, but most of it is examining Germany, the Netherlands, other places where people are using this religion as a way to challenge these exceptions to the norms. And I find it to be brilliant, insightful. There's an entire section of this film that kind of compares, you know, it talks about what the standard for what a religion is and why we should respect religion and why, you know, having religious institutions be tax exempt, for example, is a good thing. And then it shows like why that is absolutely not the case. And I love it. I'm not a fan of organized religion at all. And I find the Pastafari religion to be in my opinion, objectively the best religion, because it is the only religion I know of that straight up says, don't be a douchebag. It says, hey, if there's anything you're considering doing in my name that's bad to anybody, don't do it. Like, literally, that's their doctrine, is don't blame it on me if you want to do something bad to somebody. And it's, I find this to be insightful and, like a scalpel to belief, right?
Jeff, it's, are you a Pastafarian now?
I kind of want to be.
Yeah.
I mean, other than
I
the
see
fact
your
that
hat.
I don't want to,
like, I
don't
see
want
you
to be
hiding
any...
the hat right now. So,
yeah, well, it's just messing up my hair is the problem. I find this, the documentary to kind of, outline the idea behind this in such a smart way, in the sense that it is not straight up saying, hey, these people are parodying all of religion. In fact, they explicitly say they are not. They explicitly say that is not our goal here. Mm-hmm. But it is that, even that is a parody of the religion, right? That it is such a brilliant strategy to show how ridiculous it is to have this nonsense part of ingrained in our laws.
Right.
Like the idea that somebody can go, I have a religion now, and therefore I don't have to pay taxes. You know, somebody that can, these televangelists who are flying jets that they paid for with tax-free money that they scammed from people. It's pretty amazing. And then you have these people in court saying, well, Pastafarianism isn't that. And they go, okay, why?
Yep,
and they go, well, yep. It's not serious and not this and not that. And it's like,
let's look at a lot of other recent religions. Yeah.
Yeah. I can show you a number of, like, there's nothing, there is nothing to differentiate it. When it comes right down to it, there is nothing to differentiate it.
Other than maybe like time. Right. Yeah. Other than
time. Exactly.
It's funny. It's funny. Like, what would happen with time, by the way, is because you can think of like a lot of other religions that have started out with this idea of like, hey, just don't be a dick. That's what we are. Right. Fast forward hundreds, you know, of years, maybe thousands of years. There's a war somehow. Like,
right.
In 500 years, there will be the
500 years.
War.
Pastafarians are murdering people who aren't converting to Pastafari.
Yes.
I think is really where this is heading, Jeff.
Well, perhaps.
That's
but
just
I,
humanity,
I think if,
Jeff. Come on.
If you saw their, I think if you saw their doctrine, it's pretty funny. It's basically like, you know, it's basically saying straight up, don't do any of that. You know, like if are you mad at somebody worshiping a different god than me? Don't be, we're all nonsense. You know, like that's in the, it's pretty great. I happen to really love it. And I think the documentary does a great job of sort of laying all that out in a really cogent way. And I recommend iPastafari. I watched it. I don't remember. I think it was on iTunes. It was like $6 to rent. I enjoyed it.
I'll check this out. Like, honestly, I was also meaning to watch Hail Satan recently, too, because kind of covering similar territory.
Similar territory, yeah. Hail Satan's available on Hulu, by the way. Mm-hmm. But, Jeff, iPastafari is available to rent for $5, or you can buy for $8.
Right.
But that extra $3, you didn't want to roll the dice on that one, huh?
I don't. Why do I want to own things, Dave? I'm in a post-ownership world, baby.
I thought that only referred to physical things.
Yeah, but like, okay.
Yeah.
You're anyway. Not really owning it. You're just giving yourself the license to watch it.
Yeah, you're giving
you want.
Yourself the license to watch it anytime you want. But
there's always something else that needs to be watched. You know?
It's actually really true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I probably would roll my dice and do the purchase on this one, though.
I do the purchases because I want to support like the people who are still
releasing
things.
Remember how you're killing
now.
Cinema, Jeff?
Yeah,
remember
Jeff,
how you're killing cinema?
This is your livelihood, Jeff. Come on.
I forgot that I'm single-handedly murdering cinema.
You're single-handedly murdering cinema by not giving this person more money.
Yeah.
So,
but you remember do you remember how everyone wants to watch things at double speed because there's too much to watch?
Sure.
Remember that?
I do remember
painful
that.
Painful premise, watch at double speed. You know, the creator still gets the money. It's fine.
Yeah.
The movie is iPastafari, a flying spaghetti monster story. It's available on video on demand for purchase right now.
Great title.
All right, let's move on in the show. We want to thank people who donated to the podcast this week. Sharif from San Francisco writes in with his donation. Hello, /Filmcast. I've been listening to you guys since 2013, so this donation is shamefully long overdue. Between Jeff's limericks, David's boom goes the dynamite jokes, and Devendra's defense of Chappie, you guys feel like old friends who I can count on for honest and humorous discussion every week. With this, I was hoping you guys would give a shout out to my friend Ali, who introduced me to the show way back. Ali and I have bonded over movies back in college, and we still to this day continue our tradition of talking Oscar picks and bickering over our summer movie wager. He and his lovely wife Liz just had their first baby. Aww. I can only imagine how difficult it must be taking care of a baby in the middle of a pandemic in New York, but I know he has you guys to keep company and educate on all the new dad movies he needs to start paying attention to. You definitely helped me stay sane during these past few months. Thank you for the endless entertainment, and keep up the good work.
Oh, that's
Yay.
Great.
Congratulations, that comes... Ali and wife.
Yeah,
that's rats. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lloyd Case writes in with his donation. Longtime listener, first time donor, tell Jeff to hang in there. If he doesn't want a cat, a miniature dachshund is hell on mice and rats.
Again, more animals is not the solution to less animals. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I know what you're saying. You know,
although
this,
I did grow up with a dachshund and they are adorable.
This guy's mention of Chappie, by the way, reminds me. Have you guys heard of this this Hollywood auction for props that's happening in the next couple
weeks?
Yes.
Are you kidding me? Yeah.
There's a massive auction going on. It's called the Entertainment Memorabilia Live Auction in Los Angeles. Treasures from Film and Television. This auction's happening on August 26th and 27th. If you Google it, you'll see the catalog online.
There is some incredible stuff.
There is
what should we all go in on together as a family? What should we do?
The replica, the scale model of the Nostromo, I believe, from Alien is up
That's
there.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
There's a lot of
stuff. The reason I bring this up is because there is a full-size Chappie in this auction.
Lot
155, full size Chappie, title character robot with replica head.
What is the cost? How much?
Let me read the description.
It's an auction, okay. Right? So you don't know.
A full size Chappie, title character robot with replica head from Neil Blomkamp's dystopian sci-fi film Chappie. Damaged human-like law enforcement robot Chappie, played by Charlton Copley, fell into the hands of a group of gangsters. The film featured a number of Tetraval police scout robots, and title character Chappie had the unique designation number 22. He was designed and created by Weta Workshop for the film and features a huge number of design components. End quote. Anyway,
I would love to own Chappie. I am not
estimated,
joking.
Estimated cost of Chappie. Okay, so it gives you an estimate of how much it's going to go for.
I'm guessing.
What do you guys think is the estimated cost of Chappie?
$30,000.
Estimate between $10,000 and $15,000.
Mm. Okay, that's fair.
Devendra, you're an order of magnitude too low here, man.
A little bit, but I have a Chappie brand. I really have to keep it up, and I would love Chappie in the background of all my like video shots. It'd be amazing.
That would be pretty cool background swag. Yeah,
there's a lot of good stuff.
There's incredible
in this
stuff here. I have to be honest; like, I have considered potentially putting in a bid for some of these things.
Yeah.
One of the objects that I was thinking of, but like, it's a terrible idea, and I should not do it. And don't assume I'm going to do it. Okay. I'm just saying, hey, I fantasize a little bit about doing this. Is the soap from Fight Club?
Oh my god.
So there is a film poster soap bar made for the promotion of David Fincher's Fight Club, and you guys know he holds a bar of soap that says Fight. It's like Fight Club is like etched into the soap itself, right? Estimated cost $2,000 to $3,000.
That's not bad.
I told my wife about this possible Fight Club soap I was going to maybe bid on, and she said, then she looked down at her phone, she punched some things in, and she showed me an eBay listing for a soap that looks almost identical that's $80. but then I kept trying to say, this is the one that was used in the poster, though. Anyway. Just a pro tip for anyone out there, you can get Fight Club soap that says the words Fight Club on it for much less than $2,000 to $3,000.
It's funny. I was listening to This Week in Tech, which is a show that Devendra frequently guests on. And I have guested on several times as well. And they were talking this last week about there's an auction for the Fire Festival memorabilia as well.
Yes.
Good God.
Well, that's from the Justice Department is doing that. So that's
exactly.
Not,
yeah. Yeah, it's the government that seized it. they're auctioning off. You can get like the actual hat from the Fyre Festival. And one of the people that was on, Brianna Wu, said her friend wants to buy the hat. It'd be like $500. And they were trying to convince her, like, you could make the hat at any like online print store and it would be indistinguishable. So my question to you, and I think this is exactly the same thing you're talking about with Fight Club soap, does the knowledge that it's the actual, even if it is indistinguishable, if it has been created in a perfect replica, just does the knowledge that it's the one from the thing mean enough to you that you would pay that much more?
The answer in general is yes. However, the problem with the Fight Club soap specifically is that it wasn't actually in the movie. You know what I mean? Like, it was part of the marketing for the movie.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, do I really care that much about the marketing for the movie? You know what I mean? And but the reason I gravitated towards the soap too, by the way, is that my current house is not built to display like Michael Corleone's suit from Godfather 2. You know what I'm saying? So like a soap is one of the only things I feel like I could put in a case, and like
it needs a whole wall
but anyway, the answer to your question, Jeff, is mostly yes, I would say.
Yeah, you will get a certificate of authenticity, and you could resell this thing like later to an even bigger Fight Club fan.
Yeah, there you go.
Is it because it's a piece of history that was in a moment that is historical and important to you, or is it because there's only one of them and you've got it?
I think it's more like I really want to wash myself with this soap.
You should not own this soap then.
You've never felt clean in your life, and you can finally feel clean.
That's correct. Anyway.
Guys, check out this Robin Williams sword from Hook, which is a thing I would love to own. $12,000 to $16,000 estimate. I would, yes. Mm.
Yeah, and anything else strike your fan? I mean, there's so much. Wolverine's bone claws from the 2009 James Mangold Wolverine is in here. You know, like,
that's pretty good. Tom Cruise's Maverick pilot helmet, $50,000 to $70,000. That's pretty high.
I'm just pulling this up now.
Yeah, it's just so much good stuff here. Anyway.
Wow, monkey skull from 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yep.
Helen Hunt's coveralls from the movie Twister.
The only thing that survived that movie.
Anyway, there's a lot of stuff here. If you're thinking of putting in a bid, /filmcast@gmail.com, let us know.
A miniature of the Airwolf helicopter?
Yep.
From Airwolf?
/filmcast@gmail.com, let us know if you're putting in a bid.
And now that theme song is playing in your head. Too.
A lot of Terminator 2 stuff. That's pretty compelling. Okay.
A lot of alien stuff. Sorry. Now you guys have got me looking through this. We can move on. Yeah.
More donations. Donald McCoy, Thomas Lane from Helsinki, Finland, and a donation on behalf of Beavis Bowen, I think it was. Dan Kleinberg donated, and also Bridget M. writes from Arlington, Massachusetts, my old stomping grounds. My husband, Paul, has terrible taste in podcasts that he's always pushing on me. That's the whole message. No, I'm just joking. She goes on, yours is the exception, a respite from the others. I was hoping you could wish him a happy 40th birthday. Given Dave's history of these shout-outs, perhaps a happy 41st as well, just to be safe.
Talking about the fact that
I sometimes am a little bit late to the trigger on these shout-outs. But if you want to donate to the /filmcast, you can always donate to us by going to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. Oh, sorry. One other donation. Someone named Tuck Frump donated. P.S. We all fall down. So take from that what you will. All right,
Jeff, write that script. Come on.
We all fall down.
Come on.
Paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. Never donate if it in any way causes you any hardship whatsoever. But if you want to throw some cash our way, we'd really appreciate it. You can always start a subscription to the /filmcast as well by going to /film.com, click on the /filmcast tab, use the PayPal links on the side of the page. Before we get to our review, we're doing a new segment this week. Rather than put all the links to stuff that we're involved in at the end of the show, we're going to do weekly plugs. Every week, we're going to plug one thing that we think you should check out. It could be something we made. It could be something else made. Let's do weekly plugs this week before we get to our review. So I'll start off with a weekly plug. On one of my other podcasts, Culturally Relevant, I did an interview with Mike Bithell, who created hit games such as Thomas Was Alone and John Wick Hex.
Yeah.
And interesting guy. I talked with him about his process writing Thomas Was Alone and making John Wick Hex, and it was a great conversation. Check it out at Culturally Relevant, wherever your podcast can be downloaded. That's my weekly plug this week. What about you, Devendra?
I recently did an episode of the Engadget podcast about the big tech congressional antitrust hearing that happened last week. We dove into kind of like, yeah, everything going on there. Why specifically Apple, Google, and everybody was called up, and maybe Microsoft should have been there too. So I feel like we had a really good chat. Be sure to check out that episode with me and my co-host, Sherlyn Lowe.
That's the Engadget podcast. And yeah, I think I saw my boss testify at that thing. Also, yeah. Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
All of our bosses. It turns out the bosses of the world were there. It seems like every week I get a tweet at some point during the week of somebody going, wait a minute, We Have Concerns is back?
Yes.
We Have Concerns is back. The award-winning comedy science podcast that I do with Anthony Carboni. We did it for 4 years. Like I said, won awards. And then we stopped. Now it's back. We brought it back. And it's been going on for several months now, back in a new format, longer form. And this last week, we had a guest on, Dr. Kiki Sanford. I'm sure lots of people know Dr. Kiki. She's amazing, so brilliant. She is a neurophysiologist, a science communicator. She does This Week in Science. Brilliant, smart person. We have done over 600 episodes of our science podcast, and it's the first time we had a scientist on. So, you know, new ground for us. It's very funny, fun show. She is delightful. Surprising no one, but also bringing some wonderful positivity and optimism, truly, to science and the science stories we're talking about. We talked about the CRISPR and what it means to be able to edit our DNA. And I highly recommend you checking out We Have Concerns. You can find it at wehaveconcerns.com. And that episode is episode 600 and something. I can't find the number. Anyway, it's the most recent episode.
All right, that's We Have Concerns. That's our weekly plugs for this week. Let's get to our review of Relic.
When was the last time you spoke to her?
It's been a few weeks. Gran? Mom? She called me a few weeks ago. I think she was scared. She thought someone was coming into the house.
Tea?
Do you know where you were, Mum?
I suppose I went out.
What's this?
I was on the property when your grandfather inherited it. His mind wasn't there in the end.
That was from the trailer for Relic, the new film out on video on demand. You can rent it right now. And it was directed by Natalie Erica James. It was her first film.
Amazing.
Amazing accomplishment, in my opinion. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. A daughter, mother, and grandmother are haunted by a manifestation of dementia that consumes their family home. Devendra Hardwar, your thoughts on Relic?
I absolutely love this movie. It is astonishingly creepy. I think a really well-told story of a family that's dealing with dementia. Like you know, they're dealing with an older family member having dementia, not quite understanding how to cope with that. But the way this movie expresses it is in like true horror movie fashion. And I don't think, I feel like if this was done badly, it could be something like maybe more like the Shyamalan thing, you know, The Visit, where an older person having an illness just seeming creepy for no reason could be exploitive. But I don't think that's it. Like, to me, this movie is just like it is a beautiful horror exploration of this theme. And We'll definitely talk about like the ending and everything, but as a horror movie, it worked well for me because I feel like it did a great job of setting up these really creepy moments, and just there aren't really set pieces, but every moment it feels like there is looming dread in this movie. And to me, that's my favorite kind of horror movie. That's like The Ring. That's The Shining. That's so many different things. Yeah, I loved it completely. And man, I want to see Emily Mortimer in more things too, especially like genre things like this, because she is fantastic as always.
Jefferson Cannata, your thoughts on Relic?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts about Relic are best summed up in the form of a limerick. You guys are not going to like this.
Oh, boy.
Uh-oh.
At least Devendra's not. I thought 90 minutes was quick until I watched this flick. It's vague and it's dull, and I'm racking my skull to even get why it's titled Relic.
Wow. Oh, man. Jeff. Jeff.
It's rough.
The one thing you can't really complain about is the title, but okay, we'll talk about that in spoilers.
I guess. This movie did not work for me at all. This is an 89-minute movie, I believe, and 60 of those minutes, nothing happens other than something that's mildly annoying or, there's mild strangeness. It's a sad thing that we, I get it. It's sad that dementia is a horrible thing, and getting old is a horrible thing. It's a sad thing. A horror movie, it is not until the last 20 minutes. And I found this completely lugubrious, dull. One of the things I love about the horror genre, I grew up reading Stephen King because, and this is like, 12, 13, 14 years old, loved that genre because it was supernatural stuff in present day, right? That's, there was a lot of Star Wars, which I loved. There was a lot of sci-fi things that I read as well. There was a lot of fantasy, but the only people that were really doing supernatural in modern times and in normal everyday life were horror writers. At least that was my experience. And
sure.
So I got really into horror as a genre at that age because I loved that expression of fantasy, of sci-fi, of this magical storytelling that had rules and had, had an interesting lore and mythos about it. It was always such an interesting look at the supernatural. And that's what I like about horror movies. I'm not a horror fan per se these days. I don't seek out horror movies the way some of my friends do. But when I find great horror movies like The Orphanage, for example, mm-hmm. or, there's a number of great horror films that I love, or what's Jordan Peele's first movie?
Get Out. Yeah.
Get Out. Yeah. Great, great movies in the horror genre, I think. What I love about them is how they express their supernaturalness, right? And and perhaps that's my bias. That's what I'm looking for when I hunker down for a horror movie is like an interesting supernatural tale. And I understand that this movie is more of an allegory or a metaphor,
sure.
But it just didn't hold together on the most fundamental level for me. I wasn't compelled by it. None of the rules mattered. It was just doing some stuff and most of it wasn't particularly very interesting to me. And despite some, I think, lovely performances, and I don't know, I think the end, which we will talk about, is actually the most interesting moment of the entire movie, but it doesn't earn it. It just kind of comes out of nowhere. If it was like this short story that had that ending, I think it would be more compelling, but it feels like a padded experience, even at 89 minutes. It just did not work at all for me. Sorry.
I'm sorry you didn't like it, Jeff. I was a pretty big fan of this movie. I have to say, I really appreciated the texture of the movie. When I think of movies that have texture, I'm referring kind of in a literal way to the production design and like the actual sets they used or the locations that they shot at. And it felt to me like very little CG was used in this movie. I mean, it feels like a pretty low budget movie. And so whether or not it's true, it feels like a lot of the effects are practical. And I love like how this world looks and how they're able to convey the ideas of death and decay. There's a lot of like black in the movie, like black spots everywhere, mildewy spots.
Black mold that, type things, yeah.
Yeah, mold. And it's just like the human eye kind of recoils at that understanding that it's like unhealthy or it's not. It's certainly not living and vibrant what's there. Another movie that comes to mind when I think of like texture is Good Night, Mommy. I don't know if you guys have seen that horror film, but it's just where you really feel like the filmmaker is immersing you in the sights and sounds of this place. And I definitely got that from Relic. I definitely felt like I was in this extremely terrifying situation. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated the central metaphor of it too, right? Which is this idea that, you know, I've been thinking a lot about death recently, right? I mean, I
like when these conversations start, yeah.
For sure, for sure. I mean, I think of Kaden Cotard from Synecdoche, New York, the Charlie Kaufman movie. And he says this line in the middle of the movie. He says, quote, I will be dying, and so will you, and so will everyone here. That's what I want to explore. We're all hurtling towards death, yet here we are for the moment, alive, each of us knowing we're going to die, each of us secretly believing we won't, end quote. And that's a really powerful thought about like how many of us go through life perceiving our lives in relation to other people. Mm-hmm. And we're all the kind of the center of our own story. And what I'm struck by when I watch a movie like Relic is a person, a human being, is the accumulation of experiences, of memories, of tendencies, of attitudes, moods, and what happens when all of those change, right? Like what happens when all those things are taken away from you? What happens when you get dementia or Alzheimer's and all those things that we used to know of as fundamentally you are gone? Mm-hmm. Like, are you the same person? Are you a different person? And I think that's what Relic gets at, this idea of when someone ages, they lose many of those things that we know them from. And to their loved ones, they feel like they're becoming a stranger. And there's something terrifying about that. I think that, like,
yeah,
you know, this movie is exploring that anxiety of, like, you're living with this person. You've loved this person for decades, and then they become a stranger, yeah. Not only a stranger that you don't know, but a stranger that could harm you because you don't know them, right?
And it feels like death in slow motion in many ways too, right? Like the actual person you knew and loved is not there anymore. And I think I've seen some criticisms against this movie where the central metaphor is too blunt and too obvious. And sure, I get that. But I think the way, like you're saying, the texture of how it explores that, just the idea of living in this decaying house dealing with the house itself.
The house is a character, you could say. No, it's, I'm not going to say
it. Yeah, imagine that. But also like the way it infects this family dynamic between, you know, three different generations. Like I found that all endlessly compelling.
I really love this movie. I think you should check it out. And I will say that like I watched it at night with a good sound system, decent TV, you know, and that's a great way to enjoy it because I think like horror movies, they rely on really good sound design and to scare you. So I'd recommend you try to get some isolation when you watch this movie.
Mm-hmm. There are really jump scares. I will say that. So don't worry about that. But there are great like creepy scares. Like,
there are
just
a handful,
like,
there are a handful of
that,
jump scares.
That should not be in that frame right now, but it's all happening very slowly. But to me, that is scarier than a jump scare.
My one complaint about this movie is that I didn't really buy the relationship between Emily Mortimer's character Kay and her daughter Sam, played by Bella Heathcote. I think part of it is a casting situation. I believe the age difference between those two people is 16 years. And to me, for quite a while, I thought they were sisters, right? Like, because they're not that far apart in age, and also they don't. It didn't really strike me as a mother-daughter relationship, and I maybe that's the point, is that like, oh, they have such an atypical relationship because they treat each other like they're both kind of on the same level, you know? But
sure. Or she could have had her very young or something, like, but yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get any of that in the text of the movie, you know what I'm saying? Like, so if you're gonna make a point with that, I feel like they didn't succeed, and then as a result, we're left with two characters who look like pretty similar in age who are supposed to be mother-daughter. I understand what the movie's trying to do in terms of conveying like generational trauma from mm-hmm. what's happening, but it didn't really work for me. That said, you know, completely randomly, I watch GQ's YouTube channel, and they have this thing where they have like actors and directors go on the channel or interesting people, and like, here's me talking about the various roles of my career. They had Russell Crowe do it recently, and these are all very fascinating, and I'd recommend you watch them all. But Russell Crowe was talking about how he got the role for The Insider. He was 30-something years old. He was playing a dude in his 50s.
Yep.
And it's like, and I thought he did a great job in that movie, but you know, when Michael Mann met him to talk about it, you know, Russell Crowe said to Michael Mann, like, I don't know why you're talking to me. I'm way too young for this role. And Michael Mann's like, I don't care how old you are. Like, I see something in you that, like, you can bring this character alive, you make this character alive. And so at the same time as I'm saying, like, I didn't really buy the mother-daughter relationship and part of that is the age difference. I don't want to say that, like, it's impossible to make that happen, even if you have people who aren't the perfect ages for your characters.
Right.
I just don't know that it succeeded in this particular case.
I mean, so, I bought it in as much as like it was just very, very strained. And I was trying to figure out like what happened between them. Like she seems like the young daughter who doesn't quite live up to her mom's expectations, I guess, or who is kind of screwing up, and her mom is kind of a little more orderly. Like that's what I was deconstructing. So that it worked for me on that level, and seeing how they try to come together to take care of, you know, the grandmother, like that was the union, and it did kind of bring them together in a way. But yeah, we'll talk about that ending.
There's so little in of the mother daughter. It felt like they could have been sisters, and I don't know that the movie would have been impacted
right,
that much,
right.
Other than the metaphor that the movie's trying to get across, which is about generational trauma. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Let's get to spoilers for Relic starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course...
You're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
Okay. So spoilers for Relic. Let's talk about the ending. I actually... wasn't a huge fan of the ending. I thought it kind of went on for a little bit.
It shifts, yeah.
They're like, oh, now we're just going full-blown supernatural, like they're trapped in this weird-ass house, you know, in a,
but
in a maze, basically.
It was a creepy, like, thing where, like, oh, man, you... Like, guys, I just moved into a house that is, you know, larger than anywhere I've ever lived, and there are rooms here. There are nooks where I don't know where they go. You know, like there's right next to my office, there is like this long room that I think is leading to like some of the water supply or something. There's like an Ethernet cable that's sitting through my wall that has trailed through that room. But the area to navigate that is about like 1 foot wide. So for me to like get to the other end of this like corridor, I'd have to like really squeeze through a lot of stuff. I don't know what's there. Who knows what's there? There's stuff in this attic. I don't know. Like, when it gets to that point where it's just like, oh man, that room shouldn't be there. Why does this exist? This house is not up to code, clearly. that to me felt creepy on a certain level. But then, yeah, then it becomes like, oh, okay, we are going full swing into this is how this movie's representing the supernatural, you know, type of it. It's actually like changing the physical environment.
Yeah.
And by the end, like, it is, I think the whole ending scene. You know, it's straight up, like, it reminded me a lot of Annihilation, of a very, like, visually poetic way of exploring what's actually happening, because they go straight from, you know, being chased by the grandmother to, okay, they, I guess, hurt her a lot, and Emily Mortimer's character just can't leave her alone. And I think that whole final sequence is, it does come out of nowhere a little bit, but I think is ultimately moving in terms of what it's representing. Like that whole aspect of her peeling off her mother's skin to reveal somebody else entirely and loving her anyway, like that's beautiful.
Yeah. So Natalie Arca James gave an interview to Inverse where she talks about the ending, and she says that the peeling of Edna's skin is a metaphor for Kay's acceptance of her mother in the grips of late-stage Alzheimer's. Quote from James, "The peeling away of the skin is a real acceptance of how much she's changed. In a sense, she's helping to ease her load. What I think is the only thing that's scary in this film is the actual transformation and the grief and violence that comes from that. In her final form, she's very fragile and very vulnerable. That reflects how a lot of us are at the end of our lives. It's harrowing to see people who have kind of wasted away and are close to death. In helping Edna transform, it is a full embracing of the fact that it's still her mother," end quote. Jeff, did the ending do anything for you, or were you just like off the movie train at that point?
No, I said the ending was the only part of the movie I liked.
Which is like peeling off the skin, right?
Yeah, I thought everything after I'm going to go back in, I thought the sort of chase through the house, through the out the chimney wall thing, I just, none of that I found. Never scared by this movie. But I loved everything after she goes back in because it is a beautiful.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
That was just like 5 minutes though. So you love 5 minutes of this movie.
I love 5 minutes of the 89. Yeah. The expression, I mean, it is heart wrenching. This thing that anybody that is close to their parents is likely to go through.
Mm-hmm.
Not Alzheimer's in particular, but just the idea of watching them die, to be quite frank, and that the tenderness with which she lays down and holds her mother. I mean, that is something that is hard for me to even talk about as a metaphor, because you know, the idea of having to do that with my own parents at some point is just so heart-wrenching, and it's a beautiful moment. It is beautifully shot. It is exquisite, and this like husk, this thing that her mother is, that is, she's still able to sort of hold it and be close to it and know that there was some connection to something that she was. I found very moving, very moving. I didn't think we needed to go through half the stuff that happens in the movie to get there. I didn't think that all of the things that we experience actually make that moment any better or more interesting. I just felt like the movie is grinding its wheels until that moment. I felt like that 5 minutes is really says everything this movie wants to say and doesn't need any of the setup to get there. It's just, I don't know. I felt the movie felt padded even at a short runtime because there's so little that matters up until
I gotta disagree there, Jeff, because like, yeah, this movie's ending on acceptance, but there are stages that lead to acceptance, you know? And to me, like even the running through the house and them like treating her as like a monster where she is, you know, she's a fragile older woman. Like, I'm not sure how she all of a sudden had like semi super strength or something, but metaphorically what it is like, you know, them being afraid of what she's turning into and, you know, the grandmother lashing out, which can happen with somebody who's confused, an older person who's confused and doesn't know what to do. And they may be a danger to somebody and they don't quite know it. It could be when they're driving. It could just be like the way they react to somebody who walks into their room and they don't recognize their granddaughter anymore or their own daughter. It's like, yeah, it's all metaphorical. It's not like, it's not even like particularly subtle about it, because like there is a moment of rage, of raging against like what she's actually feeling. There are the moments of them trying to like really come to terms with what the grandmother is dealing with. And the whole chase sequence I found kind of fascinating too, because it does also end in like a sort of a rebirth sequence. Like they're going through that wall, you know, of their family house. Like they are reemerging in a different way than they were before.
And they come through where somebody would usually hang a family portrait.
They're coming through the hearth of the home.
Yeah.
You know, like this. The imagery in this movie is so effective, which is why, it certainly lingers on certain shots. Like certain things take time. Even that whole opening sequence of following, you know, the flooded bathtub, which again, right now, that would be a horror story to me. Like, it is creepy in a way and visually, like, intriguing in a way. Like, that's why this movie works for me. But I wouldn't say it's empty. It's just, like, the ideas it's exploring. Like, okay, like, maybe you don't, like, you're not into the way it's exploring, you know, a family wrestling through dementia. I feel that. But I don't think it's empty. Not at all.
Fair enough.
One thing I want to point out about the ending is something that I was reminded of by Vincenzo Natali, who's been a guest a couple of times on the Slash Filmcast. Mm-hmm. He made a movie called Splice, a horror film, which, by the way, has been tearing its way up Netflix charts recently.
Gotta love it.
It's so crazy. You know, that movie was a complete bomb when it came out, box office-wise.
Not with us, baby.
I was a huge fan of that movie, but the American public did not appreciate it. Then, like, a decade later, you know, it's on Netflix and millions of people watch it. Like, who can predict
vindication for Vincenzo?
I hope he feels it. I hope he feels it because we love him here on the podcast. But anyway, he was saying how when he was making Splice, and there was a character in Splice called Dren, very cool creature effects. And she has these kind of weird feet, like these weird legs. And he was saying how in horror films, it's very easy to be additive. It's very hard to be subtractive. You know, like, you can add blood, you can add on like a thing growing out of your face or whatever. It's hard to take away something. And I was thinking of that when Emily Mortimer's character was like peeling off the layers of skin from her mom, and she still recognizably looks like her mom's face. Mm-hmm. I was like, how did they, Robin Nevin, I believe is the actress who plays her. It's like, how did they do this? You know, like, do they have like a mini, like, was it like animatronic or
CG? It looks like robotic or something,
yeah, it
or
like
even puppet
like. It's just like, wow, yeah. This is like a fairly low budget movie, but they were able to like get an animatronic Robin Nevin head, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, that effect was really
because
it looks like her.
It looks like a shrunken down version of her. Yeah. And it's just like, how do they? Yeah. Anyway, it's really impressive, and just wanted to call that out. But yeah, the ending part it did drag on a little bit for me. It's like, okay, like this is not the most interesting part of the movie, right? Where she's like in the movie, she's like, oh my gosh, all the walls and the doors are everywhere.
The daughter is stuck in the house for like 15 minutes. Yeah,
she's stuck in the house for like 15. It's like, I don't care about any of this. Like, it's the everything else. Like, you know, when she's in the closet and like the plastic bag starts breathing. Mm-hmm. I thought that was incredible. There's this moment actually that I really appreciated, right, where she Emily Mortimer's character calls out to her mom, and the mom looks like she's walking away from her, but then it reveals that she's actually facing her.
The hair in the face looks like it's the back of the head. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Pretty effective way to scare people, like to weird people out, like very low budget. You know,
very
what I'm
low
saying?
Budget. Like, also, in that scene, there is like a distinctive black shadow, like right behind Emily Mortimer's character, which you could just miss.
Oh yeah, no, but I saw it.
It's just like
what is going
thing.
On there?
Like, what is? I love that. I love that in horror movie. Like, to me, that get under your skin kind of creepiness is so
and
good.
And it's never revealed. It's never explained what that is, right? Yeah. And of course, the very last shot is we find out that Emily Mortimer's character also has the bruises, right? She will also succumb in the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, all three of them laying down there, it's like this cycle. We're seeing the cycle of life. That shot is why this movie had a grandmother, a mother, and daughter, right?
Yeah.
That shot where you have, like, it's like three generations, each in different stages of their life, in different stages of this affliction that they're all, or at least two of them, are going to be cursed with. And it was very effective. It's a beautiful, beautiful shot, and very haunting. So, any other thoughts, or shall we wrap it up there?
I'm good.
All right, that's our thoughts on Relic. Overall, we liked it, and even Jeff, who didn't like it, appreciated the ending. So maybe check it out just for the ending. Anyway, that's going to bring us to the end of this review on the Slash Filmcast. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be discussing next week. In the meantime, find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. This episode's theme song comes to you from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from YouTuber Kyle Hillinger. Check out his YouTube channel. And this episode was edited by Beatty Zhang. Next week, we are going to be discussing She Dies Tomorrow, new movie by Amy Simetz, right? she dies tomorrow. You know, the one thing, guys, is like there was that movie that was released that was made on Zoom or something, right?
Yes, it does look good. Host, yeah.
Maybe we should review that in a future week, but I do think we should do She Dies Tomorrow next week. So which I think has very similar themes to Relic, by the way. But let's give it a shot, shall we? She Dies Tomorrow, I think we'll be out on video on demand by next week. And if not, we'll do the Zoom movie as a backup. But that's going to be the plan.
Isn't that only on Shudder, the host?
Host is only on Shudder. It is a good service and worth trying out for a little bit, I'd say.
All right. Well, that's it for the Slash Homecast. Until next week, keep wearing a mask, keep staying safe, staying healthy, and being considerate of those around you. We'll see you later.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.